Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
MSW Media.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 170 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It's Wednesday, April 24th. I'm Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok. We have a lot to cover today, including the first days of the Trump election interference trial, the Sandoval hearing, and the gag order hearing.
Yes, and we have some updates on Republicans in Congress. That $50 million parked Trump loan found by the Trump Organization's fiscal monitor, Barbara Jones. You remember we had Ben Mysalis on the show to discuss that. We have an update on the Trump bond in the New York Attorney General civil fraud trial, update on Rudy's bankruptcy case, and of course, an update on Lecterngate. But first, we have to thank our Hall of Fame patrons this episode. Our Hall of Fame patrons, $10 an episode, and really, you know, I can't overstate the importance of these folks to the show itself and how we're able to make this happen. So first of all, we thank Scott Greggs. Boy, would I love to be the bus driver. Fran Reichenbach, Catherine Gilbert White is totally awesome at her job. ATX Polar Bear, all podcast hosts are smoke shows. Change my mind. January 20, baby. Meg Alexander, Sharon Tikalski, Jason B., Charles Jones, and Christine G. Passion. Thank you so, so very much. You guys are truly incredible. And you know, I'm assuming I'm speaking for you, Pete, as well, but we had a wonderful time meeting a lot of you this past weekend in DC. It was so much fun.
Yeah, it really was. And it was just an amazing turnout. People were so awesome. And just so from all over the place, all over the US, some folks from Australia, some, you know, so folks from the UK, but just a tremendous turnout and just amazing folks. So it was great to meet all of you. And again, patrons, you're amazing, you know, just as people, but also because you allow us to put all this together. So thank you very much. Can't wait to do the next event and meet some more folks. And again, the next time next year, because we'll still be one way or the other, we'll either be talking about the ongoing trials or we're going to be broadcasting from the prison yard at Guantanamo. So either way, we'll find a way to do this again, maybe in a Caribbean locale, maybe in the prison yard, but we'll see.
Yeah, no, let's just move to the Seychelles. We'll do it from there.
Right.
So, you know, we're going to spend the first two blocks here talking about the first couple of days of the election interference trial because some important things have come up. We had a Sandoval hearing, we had a contempt hearing, but I wanted to talk about how we finished the rest of jury selection on Friday. So we were able to seat a full jury. And I say we, like I was there, but, you know, we the people, I guess, although I'm not a people of New York, but still us, those of us who enjoy justice. We were able to see a full jury seated with six alternates. And while I appreciate all of the incredible patrons and everything they do for independent media, I was going to try to make it up to the Trump trial. But since my name came up during voir dire, I have decided that it's probably in the best interest of preserving the integrity of the trial to stay out of the courtroom. Even though people generally, Pete, don't recognize me because, you know, I have the perfect face for podcasts. But I figured it would probably be in the best interest of not drawing too much attention to that fact. And I don't want there to be a, oh, Mueller, she wrote here at the trial, she was mentioned during voir dire and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I kind of been trying to fly under the radar on that. I'll talk, you know, talk a little bit about it here on the show. But I think it's important to kind of keep that whole thing low profile. And so I don't think I'm going to be going up to New York to participate in any way in this proceeding. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's smart. I mean, look, it's like, and I've had the same thing. It's kind of like the Schrodinger's cat effect, that when you observe a system, you change the system. It's you are not, particularly with this, and specifically for the reason you mentioned about the juror saying they followed you on Twitter. It's not the kind of thing that nothing positive can, it might be neutral, but it also might be bad. And I don't see anything, you know, other than, well, certainly the lost positive is being able to directly report. But I think you are making the right choice there, because I think the fewer distractions, the fewer, you know, sort of like random, you know, poor, improper avenues of attack for anybody who would try to do that. But why give them ammunition that they don't have? So right. I know we were both looking forward to it, but I think that's the right call.
Maybe I'll go in disguise, you know. I don't know. I just, you know, I was seeing some pretty pointed Michael Cohen tweets on Monday night, and I was like, ah, man, you should probably just lay off the social media for a while.
Yeah, I wish he would, because you know what? I mean, and we'll talk, we're like, I think the second block, or maybe the first block, talk about some of the gag order hearing. But Cohen, while not gagged, does not do himself or the prosecution any favors by, and he's not just commenting, he's like, you know, Baron von Poopy Pants or whatever he was calling him. And it's just like, come on, man, you're a critical witness. And I wish you would not do that. And I'm certain the prosecutors are kind of gritting their teeth.
Well, the defense is probably going to bring that up during his testimony. So, who the hell am I? Like, yes, I know I'm Mueller, she wrote, but I still think it's probably best to stay away from it, steer clear of it, not bring it up, not talk about it, not focus on it. Last thing I need is Jesse Waters, you know, doing a whole segment on Mueller, she wrote. So we're just going to kind of try to leave that where it is. And I would recommend that Michael Cohen do that as well. But we kicked this off with a Sandoval hearing.
Yeah. And so essentially what a Sandoval hearing, it's to let the defendant decide whether or not it's in his or her best interest to testify. So in the hearing, and it typically occurs before the trial, and prosecutors are required to outline the defendant's past legal issues and misdeeds that could be brought up on cross-examination. So in other words, hey, look, it's entirely your call whether or not you, Donald Trump, in this case, want to testify. But if you do, we get to cross-examine you. And this is, you know, an added benefit to the defendant in making that decision, saying, and if you do, here are the things that things you've done in the past, again, legal issues and misdeeds that we might ask you about. So it's kind of to put him on notice so that he and his legal team can decide whether or not they actually want him to testify. Again, my two cents separate and distinct from this reporting. I don't see any way in hell Trump right. testifies, because I think he gets destroyed on cross. But much like Michael Cohen tweeting, what Trump does, he is not a controlled client. So who knows? But in this Sandoval hearing, which was confusing because, and we'll talk about it a little bit, because it kind of came in two different segments. There were 13 past issues that the prosecutors wanted to use to impeach Trump on cross if he decides to testify. Five of them were from the New York Attorney General's civil fraud trial, including Trump's violations of the gag order for attacking the judge's law clerk. Then the fact that Trump was found not credible when he testified about the law clerk, and his history of falsifying business documents and property valuations. Now, another four instances relate to the E. Jean Carroll proceedings, the nearly $1 million in sanctions for the frivolous lawsuit against Hillary Clinton et al., me being one of the ets or the owls. And then the 17 felony count conviction of the Trump Organization. And then finally, two instances from the Trump Foundation case that was brought by Tish James. Now, Monday morning, just this week as we tape, Merchan ruled that the following can be used to impeach Trump should he testify. And it's a limited subset of what I just read. So what the prosecutors can use to impeach him are, one, the New York Attorney General civil fraud gag order violations and verdict. Two, the E. Jean Carroll verdicts, but not the sexual assault finding. And then finally, the Trump Foundation dissolution. They can't bring up the $1 million in sanctions for the RICO case against all of us, which was, and part of what I was saying is odd, is that like last week during the Sandoval hearing, the judge said, oh, well, this case squarely falls within Sandoval, but then as he did for others, and they can't, for instance, bring up the 17 count felony conviction of the Trump Organization. So I'm not sure. My assumption is Judge Merchan said, okay, this, yes, it is within this broad category, certainly within that, but I'm going to, he obviously did further narrow that down. But still, that, that's a lot. If you, think about it, if Trump takes the trial, that a hostile cross-examiner is going to get to use all of these things, the civil fraud gag order violations, the verdict. That verdict about, just this pervasive failure to accept responsibility that we've read from. And then certainly the E. Jean Carroll verdicts, even if you take aside the sexual assault finding, those are really powerful things that I cannot
defamation.
See Trump in his, right. And I cannot see Trump in his right mind. Agree.
No, I don't think he will anyway. And it's also interesting that he explicitly disallowed the sexual assault finding in the E. Jean case, but did not specifically or explicitly disallow the RICO case against you and everybody else and their mom, and didn't specifically not include the 17 count criminal indictment against the Trump Organization. So perhaps if I am the prosecution, maybe I try to bring those up in the case that Donald Trump actually testifies and see if I get objections to that. But I haven't seen those explicitly ruled out, but they weren't mentioned as what was also allowed in. So who knows how that'll shake out. Again, like you said, I don't think he's going to be testifying anyway. I don't think it's going to be an issue because that's what the Sandoval hearing is for.
Right. And there could be some weird limit too, like right saying, hey, you can't bring up the $1 million in sanctions for that RICO case, but you can bring in the judge's sort of descriptions of how it's an abuse of the legal system. So you can use the judge's judgments, but not the physical, the actual awarding of, the 970,000, whatever it was. So maybe it's parsed out that way, but I agree with you. It's not one entirely clear to me that this is like a final. And it's also not, as you said, clear to me that they wouldn't try and like get it in and be, have an objection sustained or not. So we'll see. We'll see soon enough. And I don't think he's going to testify.
No. So then we moved on to opening statements on Monday morning. And I thought that Katie Fang does this great thing on her Twitter account called Katie's Sidebar. And she kind of gave us a little bit of a lesson on litigation for prosecutors and specifically opening statements. And she said in a Twitter feed, first of all, there's a theme. And she says, I can't stress this enough. Themes are so important in opening statements because they give the jury something to relate to or connect with when listening to all the evidence. And it helps jurors follow your theory of the case. You introduce the jury to your theme in the opening statements. Frankly, it gets previewed in some subtle ways during jury selection, too. And then you weave your theme into your case all the way along to closing arguments. Also, she talks about roadmaps. Openings are supposed to be a roadmap for the jury to get an idea of the anticipated evidence and witnesses. And Katie said she'd be listening carefully to hear what the evidence will show and who will be called to the stand and how it'll be presented. To be clear, she said, this doesn't mean that you'll hear the exact order of the witnesses, but you should hear some idea of who will be called. It's not exhaustive, but the bigger names should be identified. She says here, pro tip, it's crucial to remember that in a criminal case, the defense has no burden to present any evidence or any witnesses. The burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt is on the prosecution and the prosecution only. The defense doesn't have to present any witnesses or evidence. She also mentions objections during opening statements. They're not supposed to be arguments, she reminds us. That's why they're called statements and not opening arguments. Argument before the jury is reserved for closing arguments. And Katie said she'll be looking to see how argumentative either side gets during their openings. We'll get an idea based on the number of objections. Pro tip, she says, sometimes objections are lodged simply for the purpose to disrupt or interrupt the flow of an opposing attorney. So keep in mind, not all objections are valid ones or for the right reasons.
Yeah, I agree. I really appreciated that thread. It reminded me of what Twitter was before Elon got a hold of it. And people, you just kind of randomly see something in somebody with a particular area of expertise, just like explaining something in a thread of tweets. And you're like, wow, that all makes sense now. And that's really well written. And those are good insights. So definitely agree. It's, you know, worth reading and following her. But, you know, with that in mind, let's talk a little bit specifically about the opening statements. Now, Colangelo, one of the assistant district attorneys, argued for the people in the opening, quote, this case is about a criminal conspiracy. Trump orchestrated a criminal scheme to corrupt the 2016 presidential election. Then he covered up that criminal conspiracy by lying in his New York business records over and over and over again, unquote. So, you know, to Katie's thread, that's exactly, there is the theory, right? Plain, simple, upfront, that is exactly what they are going to argue happened. They're going to lay out the proof. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's easy to understand, it's not technical, but he then kind of went through with that as like, here's the theory of the case. He methodically and chronologically laid out the scheme, starting with a meeting between Trump, David Pecker, and Michael Cohen, to pay $130,000 to silence Stormy Daniels. Then he talked about Karen McDougal, a former Playboy playmate. Keith Davidson represented her, shopping her story of affairs with Donald Trump. She had an affair with the defendant for nearly a year. Now, Howard told Cohen he thought the allegations were true, and they all discussed it. Pecker agreed that AMI would pay $150,000 for the story. AMI added other terms, and including that McDougal would appear on the cover, but it was all, at the end of the day, hush money. Colangelo continued, you're going to hear David Pecker testify about his conversations with Donald Trump about McDougal. But Trump, being Trump, didn't pay, and Pecker was frustrated. Cohen recorded a conversation with Donald Trump. You will hear it. Cohen spoke with Alan Weisselberg. You will hear the defendant say in his own voice that they should pay in cash. Instead, they paid a so-called advisory. They were, you know, called them advisory services. Now, in contrast, then, Todd Blanche provided the opening statement for the defense. One, Donald Trump is innocent. President Trump, and then went on, he's earned that title. President Trump did not commit any crimes. You've seen President Trump for years. He's larger than life. But he's here doing what any of us would do, defending himself. We call him President Trump. He earned it. He was president. He's running for it right now. He's the nominee. Now, what's interesting is that during his opening statement, he introduced some argument, which you're not allowed to do. He tried to get advice to counsel and defense in there that Trump only did what his lawyers told him to do. And there were multiple sustained objections, you know, the prosecutors objecting and Judge Merchan sustaining that, which doesn't look good at all. And in beyond not looking good in the eyes of the jury, and also if you're, you know, talking about something, you're laying out your theory and you keep getting interrupted and it starts and stops, it breaks up the flow of that opening statement. I was not impressed with the and the nice thing is too that New York the courts are kicking out transcripts every day of the session for free, so that's you know we can't hear it, which is unfortunate, but you can go and read the verbatim the day after, so that's great. But I was not, Allison, I was not impressed with Trump's sort of opening statement because I thought it was disjointed. I thought they were kind of randomly throwing a lot of stuff out there. It didn't seem to cohere well together. And I was reading something too, like it appears they are sticking to the line that like there was no sex. Donald Trump didn't have sex with Stormy Daniels or Karen McDougal. It was all, you know, just a friendship of some fans or something, which I find that's going to set up some interesting conflicting statements if they try and maintain that.
But they also kind of admit to it because they were also, I shouldn't say arguing, but saying in their opening statements that there's nothing illegal about hush money or NDAs, non-disclosure agreements. But that's not entirely the case. And I think that the what Colangelo put on for the people was much clearer because, you know, as Katie had mentioned and you mentioned, the theme here is that right there in his first sentence, there's a criminal conspiracy. Trump orchestrated a criminal scheme to corrupt the election. Then he covered up that criminal conspiracy by lying in his business records over and over and over again. And so the theme here is very clear. When you have falsification of business records, felonies, you have to have an underlying predicate crime, right? Sort of like down in Fulton County where we have RICO charges, racketeering charges, you have to have these underlying overt acts, right? And in this particular case, there were three laws, felonies that, they don't even have to be felonies. They just have to be a crime that the DA is relying on to elevate these falsification of business record misdemeanors to felonies. And the one that they're going to focus on is a New York law that says it's illegal to conspire to, you know, influence an election. That's illegal in New York. And so the conspiracy here, that's the underlying crime that elevates these falsification of business record, you know, misdemeanors to felonies. And they're going to outline that. And that's that conspiracy was covered up by that falsification of business records. And so he said it in such a clear and concise way. And, you know, here you have Trump's side just saying he's innocent. It's not illegal to to pay hush money. It's not illegal to cheat on your wife, et cetera. And I just, it's very disjointed. And honestly, Pete, I think it's disjointed because they really don't have much of a defense here. So they're just going to try to make everything confusing, throw a bunch of stuff at the wall to see what sticks. And that's really their best kind of defense in this case. As we've long said, that what's the old saying? If you don't have the facts, pound the law. If you don't have the law, pound the desk. We're going to see a lot of desk pounding from the Trump side.
Yeah. And I think two things, right? One is Trump wants his ego and his own political reasons for his attorneys to do certain things. I think they know they're not going to get an acquittal, right? They are certain based on the jury pool, based on the facts, there's no way the jury is going to unanimously acquit. And so what they are praying for is to find that one or two jurors who just on principle are going to refuse and hang the jury because that's the best they can hope for. And if all you're trying to do is hang the jury, then it doesn't, you know, you don't have to appeal for people. I mean, there was one point some reporting when the jury came in, like everybody stood up except for Donald Trump, like all the attorneys. You know, that's just, you know, giving a middle finger to the jury, giving a middle finger to the court and the process in general. But I don't think at the end of the day, it's not there. They are just trying to find one juror to hang it. And the thing too, I mean, what is good, I think, for the prosecution is this is not like the civil fraud trial where jurors had to wade through all these property tax valuations and look at accounting records and review the books and hear from experts about how you calculate value. This is it's a straightforward case, but think about it. You're talking about, you know, the National Enquirer, you're talking about tabloids and how tabloids are published and how they decide what they're going to publish. And you're going to hear about porn stars and you're going to hear from porn stars. And then potentially you're going to get the, you know, the glamorous assistant in the form of Hope Hicks and Michael Cohen, the fixer who, you know, so many people know. So there, it is a interesting storyline with interesting people. And if I'm a prosecutor and I'm trying to tell a story, hey, this is a great narrative and with some great characters. Now, there are plenty of pitfalls, but in terms of like being able to get the jury engaged, this is on the scale of like horrible things to have to, you know, work a jury through in terms of elements of a crime to really compelling, engaging ones that you don't have to work too hard. This is that, right? I mean, this is a great story to be able to tell a jury in the context of allegations of, you know, proving something illegal was done.
Yeah. And they don't waste a lot of time either as soon as they got Pecker on the stand. But they didn't do that until after they had a quick contempt hearing on Tuesday morning. And we'll talk about that after this quick break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Hey, welcome back. We have more Hall of Fame patrons to thank. Christine Tackner, Chris Simpson, Ren Special K Kadu, Patty B, Suzanne Ashworth, A Dinosaur in Dental School, Pinky, Maris Lawson, Greg Krimer, BackdropBooks.com, and Star Lanus. Again, thank all of you. You are superstars. You are the just absolute amazing supporters of the program, and just tremendously honored by your support and for your continued patronage. So thank each and every one of you so much. And with that, let's move on to day two. So day two of the trial began with a contempt hearing about potential violations of the gag order. Now here's what District Attorney Alvin Bragg argued in his brief about the violations. Quote, "Defendant's social media posts are indisputably about known witnesses in this criminal proceeding. He explicitly names both Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. Defendant's social media posts concern Cohen's and Daniels' participation in this criminal proceeding. Timing alone supports such a conclusion. It is no coincidence that defendant has ramped up his attacks on these two individuals just as his criminal trial is about to begin. The sheer proximity of defendant's statements to these witnesses' forthcoming testimony establishes that his attacks are directed at their involvement in this trial. Context further reinforces this connection. Defendant's April 10 posts about Cohen and Daniels were made shortly after he published a lengthy screed calling this trial, quote, communism at its worst and election interference at its best, unquote. describing this court as, quote, a, all caps, highly conflicted and corrupt judge whose hatred for me has no bounds, unquote, labeling the district attorney a, quote, unquote, Soros prosecutor, and insulting the court and district attorney as, quote, unquote, animals who, quote, want to put the former president of the United States, all in caps, in jail for doing absolutely nothing wrong, unquote. Defendant's April 13 post about Cohen was similarly made in the middle of five successive posts all about this criminal trial, several of which specifically criticized this court and the district attorney. Defendant's statements about these two witnesses were thus of a piece with his broader invective about this criminal trial, making unmistakably clear that his attacks concerned the witnesses' involvement in this proceeding. Finally, the content of defendant's social media posts all relate to matters that are directly connected to Cohen's and Daniel's participation in this criminal trial. For example, defendant's April 13 post asks whether, quote, Michael Cohen has been prosecuted for lying, unquote. And his April 10 post vilifies Cohen as well as Daniels as quote-unquote sleazebags who engage in, quote, lies and misrepresentations, unquote. That claim parallels defendant's efforts in this trial to preclude Cohen's testimony because of his purported lack of credibility. Indeed, defense counsel has told the court and the people in multiple filings that he intends to confront Cohen on cross-examination with past incidents of untruthfulness. Defendant's extrajudicial statements are thus a direct attack on Cohen's credibility in this trial that parallel the overt defense strategy here. The same is true of defendant's statements about Daniels. Defendant's April 10 social media post reproduces a statement by Daniels from 2018 that directly concerns events relevant to the criminal charges here, including an explicit reference to quote-unquote hush money. There's little doubt that defense counsel will seek to use this very statement to attempt to impeach Daniel's credibility at the forthcoming trial. Defendant's extrajudicial preview of that defense tactic thus constitutes a statement about a witness concerning her participation in this criminal trial.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Trump's argument here is that these posts specifically were political in nature. So I thought it was really important for the DA to show the chronology of all the other posts about the trial, you know, and you get one of these posts smack dab in the middle of a bunch of posts about the trial, and to try to say that that post wasn't about the trial and it was just political in nature and he was defending himself, first of all, indicates that Trump knows exactly what the gag order says, okay, and that he is doing everything he can to walk right up to the line and, it, you know, if not just completely flout it. So the contempt hearing began. There were about 10 violations, right? Plus two additional things that he said on a conservative talk show and then outside the courtroom the day after the first day of trial. And Conroy was arguing for the prosecution. And he talked about that alleged 11th violation and said, for the record, yesterday, here in this building, right outside those doors, the defendant violated the order on camera. He did it right here in the hallway outside. He says Trump did this willfully and flagrantly, all of the posts, and that the court should now hold him in contempt for each of the 10 posts. Trump, by the way, was falling asleep again at this point. And it's important to note here, somebody had brought up on Twitter from Lawfare that the reason that the fine is just $1,000 per violation, that's actually the statutory max for a gag order violation in New York if you're not going to go for prison or jail, which is 30 days. So that's why it's $1,000 per, not because we're going to start with a low number and go up later. Obviously, they're not going to start with jail first. And the DA says they're not asking for jail. They're asking for $1,000 per violation. That's the max. So I just wanted to kind of make that clear to everybody. Now, Conroy worked his way through the posts fairly quickly and tied them in context to the other posts talking about the trial. And the judge asked him to connect the posts to specific stipulations in the gag order. And Conroy said, by calling them sleazebags, for example, by going after their credibility, that's part of the plan for this trial. It's the defendant conditioning his followers. And he reads, you know, actually Conroy reads what the gag order says and says, this is clear. These are clearly violations and here's why. And then Conroy brought up what Jesse Waters did during jury selection last week on Thursday night. and said that that actually resulted in juror two quitting the jury. And the Waters example is a hybrid of something someone else said, quote, they're catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge, unquote, with something that Trump added, quote, in order to get on the Trump jury. And that's an important point made by the prosecution, Pete, because they're saying that Trump wasn't just directly quoting Jesse Waters. He was adding his own spin to what Waters said, making it non-passive violation of the gag order. But Trump is trying to argue his posts are political speech, therefore not violations of the gag order. Like I said, and all the posts here were made in relation to the criminal proceeding, because that's what Conroy argued. He said, we know that from the words, it's just very clear they relate to this case. Just because you put the word MAGA in a post doesn't make it just political. It may make it more ominous, he said. And Trump was knowingly and willfully breaching the crystal clear, unequivocal line set by this court in the April 1st order to protect the integrity of this proceeding. Conroy went on to say, they're not yet seeking sanctions of jail time, only fines. Ordered removal of the posts, meaning please tell him to take these posts down. And for the court to issue another warning and admonishing Trump that this won't be tolerated and that incarceration is an option should it be necessary. Then when Todd Blanche got up, again, Todd Blanche argued that the posts were political speech and Trump was merely defending himself. They began going through the 10 posts one at a time and took an exceptionally long time on the first one, and Judge Merchan became notably irritated with Blanche. Blanche argued the witnesses themselves can constantly comment on whatever they want, and Trump, in theory, cannot respond. He also argued that the mention of the pardon in Michael Cohen's post is what makes it political in nature. Judge Merchan asked if Blanche had spoken to Michael Avenatti, and then he said no, and then the judge said, well, then how can you infer what he meant? And this was a pretty astounding part, Pete. Blanche got up, brought up two posts that could be potential violations, but were not brought up by the prosecution, and said that because the prosecution didn't bring these two potential violations up, the whole gag order should be waived. He literally, that was his argument. And the judge is like, that's silly. That doesn't negate the validity of the gag order. And then they talk about the difference between posting and reposting, right? Because Trump argues that if I retweet or retruth something, that's not a violation of the gag order, as opposed to if I personally made the post myself. And the judge said, so it's your client's position that when he was reposting these things, he was not violating the gag order? Are you testifying under oath that that's your client's position? That's what the judge said to Blanche. And Blanche really, he couldn't get a straight answer out of him. He tried to end on this point. He said, we're trying to comply with the gag order. Trump is being very careful. But then the judge cuts in and says, you are losing all credibility. I'll tell you that right now. So that was pretty intense. I noticed, you know, I was watching MSNBC. A lot of former prosecutors are on there and they're like, I've never heard a judge tell a lawyer you're losing all credibility. And then Blanche blamed the court for not being crystal clear about reposts versus original posts in the gag order. And the judge says, well, what you should have done is probably said to me, my client is thinking of reposting things. It's not real clear in the gag order. So Judge Merchan, is that allowed? But you didn't. Right. And then before the end of the hearing on Tuesday morning, Conroy gets up for the people on his rebuttal in response to Blanche's argument that Cohen and Daniels can say whatever they want, you know, but Trump can't respond. So Conroy reminds the court that Cohen and Daniels are not criminal defendants in this case, nor are they under a gag order. So I thought that was pretty great. And oddly enough, they took a quick break. They came back, no ruling, and they brought Pecker up to the stand. And so far, Pete, Pecker's testimony, it started out back in the 80s when he met Trump, and it moved up to the early 2000s when he started to talk to Trump more, because in 2003, The Apprentice came out. And Pecker was kind of getting some good, juicy stories about that. But it really didn't start in earnest, his meetings with Michael Cohen, until the campaign. And that is a foundation for that conspiracy, right? That conspiracy to impact the 2016 election. And they got to it pretty quick. You know, it's right now as we record this, it's Tuesday, and they are currently right now talking about how Pecker met with Cohen and another lawyer named Keith Davidson and Trump, and they all got together and decided that they, for the campaign, would post positive stories in the Inquirer about Donald Trump and negative stories about his opponents. And some of the headlines were pretty great, some of these negative headlines. But that's sort of where we are right now. We also learned that the second predicated law is the one that they're going to be using at the core of this case as the criminal conspiracy. And let me just read that for you real quick. It says, under the second theory, the people allege that Trump intended to violate New York election law, section 17-152, by conspiring to promote the election of any person to a public office by entering a scheme specifically for purposes of influencing the 2016 presidential election, and that they did so by unlawful means, including by violating the FECA through the unlawful individual and corporate contributions by Cohen, Pecker, and AMI, and by falsifying the records of other New York enterprises and mischaracterizing the nature of the repayment for tax purposes. So there's other ones too. There's a federal campaign violation that underlies these falsification of business record felonies. And then there's also a tax law that when Cohen was reimbursed for the $130,000 payment he made, it was grossed up to compensate him for taxes. So that's another violation of law. They paid him back more to make up for the fact that he would have to claim that on his taxes as income. And that's a tax violation of New York tax law. But it's that conspiracy to influence an election that is against New York law. It's not charged. The conspiracy is not charged, right? But that is the, and it doesn't have to be, and it doesn't have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt either, to be the underlying predicate crime that elevates these falsification of business record misdemeanors to felonies.
Yeah, I mean, a bunch of things that were notable, and I'm with all those folks who kind of ears perked up when Merchant said, you're losing all credibility, I'll tell you right now. Like, I have never heard in a courtroom a judge tell attorneys that they're losing credibility. And these are not like, look, this is not Alina Haba. Like, that Blanche is a serious attorney, and that you can tell Emile Bove is a serious attorney. You can tell where Trump really cares because he gets real attorneys in there. And so for any... And real attorney, you know, meaning somebody who, you know, has a good professional reputation, who wants to maintain a good professional sort of view in the eyes of the bar and otherwise, to have a judge saying that is really problematic. And I'd be at eye level, if Merchant does not sanction Trump for some of these, I would be surprised. And the problem is going to be, I don't think it's going to stop Trump. $1,000, you know,
no.
Times four or five or three or whatever it is, Trump doesn't care about that. So then the question is, if Trump pays his $7,000 and continues, and you know he won't be able to constrain his childish temper when Cohen, at a minimum, is on the stand, I would be shocked if we didn't see more. What do you do then? You can't, like, wave your finger really sternly and find him another $1,000. I'm very curious to see when he continues to violate the gag order after having been sanctioned, however much money I think he's going to get sanctioned, do they up it to asking for confinement?
Next step, because it's still $1,000 no matter what. And that being the statutory maximum, Pete, the way that Trump probably sees this is, it only cost me $1,000 to discredit witnesses. It only cost me $1,000 a pop. Let's keep doing it. And if I get thrown in jail, do you know how much money I'll raise? It'll be incredibly, likes of which you've never seen. People will come to me with tears in their eyes. And that's the way he's viewing this. To me, that's what it seems like. For $1,000 statutory maximum, it's only costing him $1,000 a crack to go after these witnesses and potentially influence jurors. That's right. The way that I'm seeing it. And Bove, by the way, Emile Bove, he's only there because he is the SIPA expert in the documents case, and they're trying to delay the documents case. And so they're trying to say, we can't do anything in the documents case down in Mar-a-Lago for the next, I should call it the espionage and obstruction case, but we can't do anything for the, until 3 weeks after the trial in New York, because my SIPA expert is also one of the lawyers in my New York criminal trial. I am 100% sure that's the only reason Emil Beauvais is up there and doing anything in New York, is to keep that Mar-a-Lago case on ice.
Yeah, that's probably going to work. And there is, like, a part of what has greatly been absolutely largely overlooked because of the trial is, like, there was a large amount of redacted information. And I'm sure you and Andy will talk about it on Jack podcast. But there's a ton of detail in there and a ton of information about folks that have been interviewed, about the search that took place. But nobody's really talking about it because everybody's focused on the trial. And, you know, to your point, it is kind of absurd to me that, you know, he is specifically trying to arrange his legal team in a way to create conflict. And, you know, every time, like, oh, this judge is moving so fast and it's never been seen before. It's like, well, why? If you're innocent, don't you want to clear your name so you can just have it out of the way and go campaign without it hanging over your head? And it's like, no, okay, so that doesn't make a lot of sense now, does it? So, unfortunately, I think with Judge Eileen Cannon, it'll probably work. And is what it is. Not anything we're going to do about it.
Yeah. Yep. Then we'll see. I mean, we're going to keep watching this trial. We'll talk about it more. I know we'll get into more of the Pecker testimony next week on the main episode. And I think, you know, it's important to note why Pecker is going first. I think he's probably got the most information on this conspiracy, which is the underlying predicate. And that's laying the foundation for everything that came later. So I know Pete will get more when they start talking about the hush money payments to the doorman for $30,000, Karen McDougal, $150,000, Stormy Daniels, $130,000. We'll start seeing more of that come up in testimony as the week goes on. But you can follow, Tyler McBrien from Lawfare, Anna Bauer is tweeting this, Katie Fang, Adam Klasfeld is live tweeting. Inner City Press is also, I mean, there's a ton of people who are live tweeting this on Twitter, and we'll be getting the transcripts at the end of the day for, I think by the end of the next business day for each day. But they're coming out pretty quick, and that's pretty extraordinary. So we can keep up with that before we get back to where we're at next week. It'll be interesting to see how far we get by next Wednesday. All right. We have a lot of other news to give you updates on, but we have to take another quick break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Okay, our next batch of super awesome Hall of Fame patrons to thank. Pete Strux, Ball Tanning Salon, David Chandler, Mitchell, Deborah Kirby, Roberta Reed, Karen Sherman, Tiffany Trump was adopted, Maria Tovar, Cindy McNary. Please don't read this on the pod. We don't need a call out. Thanks for what you do. And Jeffrey Kincher. And before we get into some Matt Gaetz ethics problems, I just wanted to share with you some of these headlines that we were talking about that were brought into evidence when David Pecker was on the stand. Some of the positive Trump headlines: Donald Trump, the man, the legend. Donald Trump gets the Duke's blessing. JFK's secret son endorses Donald Trump. Donald dominates. Obama's half-brother cheering on Donald at debate. Cruising to victory. Ted Cruz endorses Donald Trump. And then some of the negative headlines about his opponents: bungling surgeon Ben Carson left sponge in patient's brain. Ted Cruz shamed by porn star, which is kind of funny. Ted Cruz, sex scandal, five secret mistresses. Donald Trump blasts Ted Cruz's dad for a photo with a JFK assassin. Family man Marco Rubio's love child stunner. Senator Marco Rubio's cocaine connection. Shady lady who could ruin Marco Rubio. Like, these are the headlines that we're talking about. And there was one that I really liked about Ted Cruz. Let me see if I could find it. It's something like, here we go. Boozin' Ted Cruz fixin' to lose. That's another one. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of touch on some of those headlines to give you sort of an idea of what was going on in the courtroom. All right, let's go to Congress. Let's talk about what happened in the Republican Congress over the past week. First of all, the Matt Gaetz ethics probe is continuing. From Daily Beast, House Ethics Committee investigators are making inquiries to find out whether Matt Gaetz took illicit drugs at parties in Florida after he'd become a member of Congress. Sources familiar with the committee's work told ABC that the panel has obtained a sworn written statement from a woman who claims to have been at a party in the summer of 2017 in Florida that Gaetz attended, alleging the party featured drugs, including MDMA and cocaine. So that's, again, going back to all of the discussions we had when he was under federal criminal investigation. There were no charges brought, but now the House Ethics Committee is getting these sworn affidavits. So a lot of retelling of some stuff that we already knew. Also, good news, the House finally reauthorized FISA, Section 702, and then so did the Senate. So that's all taken care of. Really embarrassing. Both of the Mayorkas impeachment articles were dismissed by the Senate, and the trial for the impeachment of the Senate trial for the impeachment of Mayorkas has been adjourned. And I love that somebody posted, you remember how they showed them ceremoniously walking the articles of impeachment from the House over to the Senate side? Somebody played it in reverse with Yakety Sax in the background. And I thought that was pretty great. But that was already going nowhere. Many Republicans in the Senate were like, this is stupid. So that went down. And then we did get foreign aid passed in the House. And Johnson took a lot of heat for that. We talked about this a little bit on the Daily Beans. It seems that he got a briefing from a CIA director that maybe changed his mind a little bit. I think what changed his mind is that his son just got accepted to the Naval Academy. And when it kind of directly faces you that if Putin gets what he wants from Ukraine and marches a foot into NATO territory and Article 5 is triggered, and then your son, who is maybe just graduating from the Naval Academy, has to go over into a war, then maybe you start second guessing your bullshit, you know, Trump theories about Ukraine. That's just my personal opinion as to why he may have changed his mind a little bit, kind of like when one of the Republican senators, her daughter was sexually assaulted in the military, and that's when she started to co-sponsor Kirsten Gillibrand's bills about reforming the way that military sexual assault is handled in the military. It's when it happens to you, right? It's not about other people, but when it happens to you. But the foreign aid was passed. It's in the Senate right now. It should be passed and signed. But there were some interesting amendments filed, and mostly by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And then in response, we had Moskowitz, Jared Moskowitz, with some amendments. The Marjorie Taylor Greene amendments, there were two notable ones. First was to fund space laser technology at the border. Okay, space laser technology. And one was to force anyone who votes in for Ukraine aid in Congress to be conscripted to the Ukrainian military. But then Moskowitz submitted an amendment, and his amendment was to designate Marjorie Taylor Greene as Putin's special envoy to the United States Congress. And at first I thought he's kidding. He sent me that tweet. And I said, okay, is this for real? And yes, he confirmed. And then shortly after that, we got the language of the amendment. Obviously, these didn't pass, but I thought that that was noteworthy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, she is horrendous. There was some really odd, like the wording in particular, when you look at it, the one of the amendments, and it reads, no funding shall be made available to Ukraine unless restrictions on ethnic minorities, including Hungarians in Transcarpathia, right to use their native languages in schools are lifted. Who, Marjorie Taylor Greene could not tell you whether Transcarpathia is a person, place, or thing. She could not spell it. I mean, she can't, she confuses Petri dish with Petri dishes. She confuses the Gestapo with Gazpacho. She, to see Transcarpathia showing up in any of these amendments tells you, you know, do I think she's meeting a Russian intelligence officer who's telling her what to do? Absolutely not. But it's clear the people of her district in Georgia have no interest in Hungarians in Transcarpathia and their right to use their native language in their school.
Well, I'd like to be a fly on the wall when whoever, whatever staffer wrote that, explained it to her.
No, it's going to be like, remember when Orban was in town and some of the, you know, the little people who were tooling around with him and wrote that big check for your reelection campaign? They want us to say this. And she said, oh, okay. I guarantee you it's going to be something like that. There is no, and to that end, I think it's a lot more likely that it links to something. And remember, Orban went down to Mar-a-Lago as well. Yeah. That strikes me as something odd coming there. But, you know, the rest of these jokers, Mike Johnson, that's a great question. I don't know if I can see his son going to the Naval Academy having some impact, but that's still so far off. I don't see Johnson as being that altruistic. In my mind, there is either he was briefed on something that either there was some pressure over him that was lifted, or that some of these far right wingers in MAGA world in the Congress have something there that he's trying to distance himself from. But I think he is too craven a political actor to not have there be some underhanded motive force beyond just the, yeah, it's kind of crappy that it actually takes you having personal skin in the game of your child going to a service academy, but something, I got a feeling there's something more there, and whether or not we ever know, I don't know, but you know, there clearly are, you know, enough shenanigans going around, including this from Olivia Beavers. House Freedom Caucus members are signing up to take shifts to guard the House floor in order to prevent resolutions they'd consider unsavory from slipping through that could curb their power, according to two Republican sources. I swear to God to you, Allison, I am not making this up. The Floor Action Response Team, or FART, aims to guard against a voice vote or unanimous consent vote where action could be stealthily taken against them and their members. Things like, you know, trying to strip Massey, Norman Roy from the Rules Committee to allow a change to make it harder to, remove the Speaker of the House. But I am not kidding about that name. Lauren Boebert has been running around talking about it, giggling about it, because it's fun to say fart if you're Lauren Boebert and a congresswoman from Colorado. But and why you would want to call yourself that? I don't. It's that a proud banner of I am the FART team. I don't. I must be missing something, because it to even use it, but then to use it in like not derogatory term about Trump farted when he fell asleep in the courtroom, which he by many accounts did. That to then call yourself, I don't get it.
Yeah, well, I think it's emblematic of the collective age bracket, mental age bracket of the Freedom Caucus. Although I think farts are funny. I don't want to fart joke shame people. But mostly what I see here is Republicans being afraid of something that they would do, like sitting around camping out to make sure that the Democrats don't do something underhanded without their quorum there is... Again, it's like, you know how every accusation is a confession. It's like, well, this is something they thought this is something we would do. Let's make sure they don't do it and sit around and make sure that, you know, they don't try anything. Like you said, like removing these guys from the Rules Committee without enough Republicans there to oppose it or something like that. But also emblematic of the fact that they are one car crash away from losing their majority. And it's not tenable for them. Now, Nancy Pelosi didn't have a problem with it. She was able to whip the caucus just fine with a slim majority. Republicans are having a harder time because they have the Putin Congress or the Putin caucus in Congress. So we'll see what ends up happening. I mean, we're a heartbeat away, a breath away from Hakeem Jeffries getting the gavel. There was an unreported phone call between Johnson and Hakeem Jeffries ahead of the Ukraine aid package or the foreign aid packages. Bills that went out. And I think that maybe, you know, there could have been another maybe come to Jesus moment where it's like, hey, the Democrats are the only thing standing between you and a motion to vacate. But I've also heard rumors that if anybody brings up a motion to vacate, like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Massey, that there are Republicans ready to resign and give the majority to Hakeem Jeffries. So it's that tenuous. It's that tenuous in this house. All right. We have more updates to get to, including Rudy Giuliani. Andrew Giuliani could be under the gun. We've got a criminal referral, sort of, I guess, a complaint filed by the Citizens for Responsibility Ethics in Washington. The bond update. We have to take a quick break, though. Everybody stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Welcome back. Thanks to our last group of Hall of Fame patrons, Lisa Rollison, Lance Buckley, Mr. Halfspeed, at Dirt Road Dems, Kirkland J. Bateman. Devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for an election to steal. He was in a bind. He was way behind by 11,780 votes. Clover's Tree 73. Is it Friday yet? Nathan Dorn, Dr. David, and David in Brooklyn. Thank each and every one of you so, so very much for your support. You go above and beyond. Really deeply appreciative of your support. And again, thank you so much. Now, Allison, you mentioned earlier that when we had Ben Mazzalis on the show to discuss a $50 million parked loan found by the court-appointed Trump Organization fiscal monitor, who's retired Judge Barbara Jones, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, has filed a complaint with the Department of Justice. Now, in that, they note that Donald Trump should be investigated for knowingly and willfully making false statements about debts owed to his Chicago business on his public financial disclosure reports, according to the complaint. And they filed that in Washington, D.C., with both the FBI and the Department of Justice. In late January, the Daily Beast reported on what they called a bombshell report from retired Judge Barbara Jones, who was assigned to monitor Trump and the Trump Organization's finances. And she was put there, remember, by Judge Arthur Engoron during the financial fraud trial that ended with the $355 million fine. At that time, Jones wrote that she was baffled by information being handed over to her, telling the court, quote, in recent discussions with the Trump Organization, it indicated that it has determined that this loan never existed, and thus that it would be removed from any upcoming form submitted to the Office of Government Ethics, or OGE, and would also be removed from subsequent versions of corporate financial statements. And now, CREW notes that questions about the loan have never been answered, which now has led the CREW to ask DOJ to have the FBI step in and investigate and find out where and what the circumstances were about this loan, why it was listed under penalty of perjury. I mean, when you fill out the forms, and I mean, you do it as a candidate, the presidents have to do it as a senior executive in the government, you fill out OGE forms where you list, you know, assets, and those are not just like, oh, I'm kind of spitballing. You sign it under penalty of perjury. So at a minimum, when they became aware of it and whether or not they continued listing it, there is the potential that, you know, false statements were made. And that's what CREW is highlighting to the FBI and DOJ.
Yeah, I'm surprised they also didn't give this over to the IRS or the Treasury to be like, you should check to see if this was a tax avoidance scheme. But we'll see what ends up, if anything ends up happening with DOJ and FBI. All right, let's go down to what's going on with Rudy Giuliani's bankruptcy filing. And this seems to bring, it's dragging his son, Andrew Giuliani, into the problem. So Rudy Giuliani's creditors expanded their probe into his finances, filing more than a dozen subpoenas in his bankruptcy case last Friday. The formal requests filed Friday in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of New York were made by Giuliani's official committee of unsecured creditors. And they are the ones seeking to uncover any hidden assets they believe should be distributed to them. So the official committee of unsecured creditors is everybody Giuliani owes money to. Okay. So they said, we're seeking to uncover hidden assets. The committee served subpoenas to Giuliani's son, Andrew, president of his third-party litigation defense fund, Maria Ryan, who co-hosts a podcast with Giuliani, and Giuliani's former assistant. The committee also filed document requests for corporate entities affiliated with Rudy and to Giuliani himself. The former assistant, by the way, that's Noelle Dunphy. And she's a member of the creditors committee. And she says she has access to about 23,000 of Giuliani's personal emails. She's the one suing him for millions of dollars for sexual abuse and assault and harassment.
Yeah, and talk about somebody who does have inside information and has a strong motive to get to the bottom of what Rudy has. And if he's hiding it, she's in a great place to do it. And yeah, she was also the one, right, that had those extraordinarily disgusting graphic
statements
and text messages from Rudy, which are just, don't go looking for them. I beg of you, if you're hearing like, oh, what are those? I'm sure you can find it.
You don't want to know.
Hear me now. You don't want to read them. They're just disgusting. And while we're on the spectacle of Rudy Giuliani, Judge Beryl Howell has upheld the verdict in the Ruby Freeman Shea Moss defamation case against him. With the automatic bankruptcy stay lifted for Giuliani's benefit to continue litigating in the case, she writes, he now renews his motion made at trial for judgment as a matter of law, pursuant to Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 50B, or alternatively, for a new trial and or to alter or amend the final judgment, pursuant to Federal Rule 59. She continues, Giuliani urges this court to reverse prior findings and rulings and override the jury's considered verdict based on 5 cursory arguments made in a brief 8 pages. You can tell already that by the cursory descriptor and the brief descriptor, this is probably not going to go well for Rudy. So she starts, 1, these are Rudy's arguments that he's asking, that plaintiffs have failed to state a claim, quote, incorporating by reference his arguments in his motion to dismiss case and re-arguing them as to the statements specifically identified in the complaint. 2, that the unpleaded conduct on which plaintiffs were permitted to prove damages, quote, suffers from the same defects as the pleaded conduct, unquote, and, quote, fails to adequately plead the claims for relief and or were improperly presented to the jury despite being outside the pleadings, unquote. 3, that the, quote, emotional harm statements that plaintiffs based their intentional infliction of emotional distress or IIED claims on at trial were made more than 1 year before the suit was filed, and consequently, quote, defendant is entitled to judgment as a matter of law on the IIED claims on limitations grounds, that any IIED damages were based on a lack of competent evidence because there was no expert testimony as to how much of their emotional harm was caused by Giuliani, as opposed to other sources that predated Giuliani's alleged conduct, and 5, that the testimony and documents of 2 plaintiff's witnesses, Regina Scott and Dr. Ashley Humphreys, quote, should have been stricken with an instruction to the jury to disregard it. Now, Judge Howell then goes to judgment. These arguments are foreclosed by the law of the case doctrine based on this court's default judgment decision imposing liability on Giuliani for plaintiff's claims as a discovery sanction. And Giuliani provides no basis to exempt him from application of that doctrine here and otherwise fails on the merits. Giuliani's renewed motion urging this court to reverse its prior findings and rulings and to override the jury's considered verdict on the basis of 5 threadbare arguments falls well short of persuading that, quote, the evidence and all reasonable inferences that can be drawn therefrom are so one-sided that reasonable men and women could not have reached a verdict in plaintiff's favor, unquote. The jury's verdict awarding plaintiffs compensatory and punitive damages for defamation and intentional infliction of emotional distress caused by Giuliani and his co-conspirators, as reflected in the final judgment, in the amount of $145,969,000, plus post-judgment interest stands. So there you go.
Bam.
Sorry, Rudy.
Yep. And we do have an update in that $175 million bond. You'll remember in the New York Attorney General civil fraud disgorgement verdict that Trump owes $464 million. He went out to about 30 different reputable insurance companies, and his lawyer said nobody will back that. And so the appeals court lowered it to $175 million. And then he got Mr. Hanke and Knight Specialty Insurance Company to back the bond. They filed the bond. The court rejected it because it didn't include any financial statements. They refiled it with financial statements. And then New York Attorney General Tish James objected to it because they only have $138 million in asset to liability on hand, like cash on hand to cover the bond. And the bond is more than that. And so then they said, well, we're going to cover it with one of Trump's Schwab accounts. But the problem with that was that Trump's Schwab account was, first of all, it's a Schwab account, so it can go up and down. Like it can lose value or gain value, but it can lose value. And it's still owned and operated by the Trump Revocable Trust, not Knight Specialty Insurance Company. And so Trump could just sell it all. Or convert it into bonds instead of cash or something, you know, but also it could lose value. But they said, no, Trump has promised that if it loses value, he'll true it up with additional assets like property, which isn't really liquid cash. But anyway, there were so many problems with this. The parent company is in the Cayman Islands, and there's, you know, there's the concept of ghost insurance where they transfer a lot of their liabilities out to their parent company and keep their assets on the books. So it looks like they have a lot more assets than liabilities. It's also a tax haven, as we know, commonly used to avoid paying taxes. But their parent company was reinsuring them. But so they had this a big hearing on this, Pete. And the attorney general, to my surprise, actually came to an agreement with Trump, this, you know, Trump's side, that they would use his $175 million Schwab account to collateralize this bond, and it would be backed by Knight Insurance Company if the control of that Schwab account was given over to KSIC, to Knight Specialty Insurance, taken away from Donald Trump. And so they agreed to that, stipulated to that. I haven't seen the final order. I'm assuming it'll come out at some point. But New York attorneys said, we're amenable to that. As long as Knight Insurance has control over that, and they'll give it right over to us. And the other stipulation is that Trump can't turn it into something besides cash. You know what I mean? Like he can't sell it or turn it into mutual funds or anything like that. So it has to remain immediately available liquid cash, and that Knight Insurance Company has total control of it, not Trump.
Yeah, and it, which leads me to the question, like, well, why didn't just Trump then provide that money himself directly? What is the value add to having Knight do this? I mean, if they're not taking on, you know, if the entire amount is represented in that account and Knight is not making up some difference, and maybe they are, again, we're waiting to see what the details are. You know, why does Knight need to be involved at all? So, and I would hope as well that whatever it is not in some, you know, all in Truth Social stock, that they have it in some guaranteed income, you know, like baseline 3 or 4%, that, you know, not much, but you're not going to lose value. But we'll take a look when that gets published and let you know about it. And speaking of financial shenanigans, Allison, we have a Lecterngate update. Now you may remember that down in Arkansas, that Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders spent $19,000 on a lectern, including some really shady, consulting fees that were paid to obtain the lectern, which might have included people who were social acquaintances of hers who might have been involved in junket trip to Paris. And it was so bad and smelled so bad that the state said, you know what? We need to audit this. And as it turns out, Arkansas state auditors have now completed an exhaustive, and Allison, I went through it. It is exhaustive. It is, oh my God, this is more, my eyes glazed over because I don't need that much information about a $19,000 lectern. Nevertheless, it is quite exhaustive. and extensive investigation into the purchase of that lectern by Sanders, and they referred the findings of their investigation to a prosecutor's office that oversees Little Rock to determine whether or not criminal charges should be filed. Now, it's not doesn't necessarily say, you know, we're recommending this person, that person. I was a little bit disappointed that although it is exhaustive and extensive, it doesn't, they don't really, there's no like executive summary up front that has high level like findings and recommendations. It's not like reading a DOJ IG or DHS IG report. It's very obtuse and hard and kind of hard to like figure out, okay, what exactly are you saying? But it seems to me they gathered a bunch of information and they punted it over to the prosecutor's office to let them make the call. I'm not holding my breath. But it is, you know, part of that $19,000. I mean, literally they spent thousands of dollars as a consulting fee to find the lectern, which strikes me as absurd. I mean, give an intern in your office 20 minutes and a office supply directory and the internet to go find a lectern. It's not, even if you need a custom lectern, not a hard job, but apparently there's good money to be made as a consultant down in Arkansas.
Yeah. And the fact that the Republican Attorney General of Arkansas has now said that these rules don't really apply to the governor's office, right? He said that the day before the audit report came out. I'm with you. I don't think there will be criminal charges here from the Little Rock prosecutor. But we'll keep an eye on it for you. And we appreciate you all listening today. We're still kind of keeping one eye on this trial. And we'll be reporting more on David Pecker's testimony on the next public episode. We'll see what we talk about on the bonus episode for patrons this weekend. Thank you again. If you're a patron at the $2 level, you get twice as many episodes. So thank you very much for being patrons. Thanks to our Hall of Famers this week. Really, truly couldn't do this without you. Amazing. Your support is so amazing to us. And I'm blown away by it every single day. So thank you. Thank you. Do you have any final thoughts before we get out of here today?
No, going to go back and listen to the trial. Thank you. It was amazing to meet so many of you this past weekend and look forward to doing it again. I wish there was a way to get everybody together all at once. And it's just a size. We're going to have to find a big venue so that we can take all comers. But amazing, amazing folks, all of you. And I'm blown away by the kindness of people, how smart people are every single week, the comments that we get on the Patreon site, and people's background knowledge is astounding. So you're an amazing group of folks. And patrons can't thank you enough. So I'm going to go see what David Pecker has to say, although we may be right. It was a short testimony day today, Tuesday, as we tape. So we'll see what's going on.
Yep. They're putting up all sorts of exhibits of wire transfers. They're getting into the meat of it now. We'll talk about it next week. Thank you all so much. We'll see you then. I've been Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok.
Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com. MSW Media.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.